What's wrong?
Nothing really. I just feel that I need something stronger.
If you have a problem, don't hesitate to ask for assistance.
Yes, thank you. I'll be all right.
Call 348-FUNKY. What's wrong?
All right, welcome to HPR Roundtable. This is episode number 8. My name is Sig Flup. I am the host of Demo Robust and the Uber Lead Hacker Force. With me is Clitu of the Bad Apples.
Hi, everyone.
We also have Deep Geek of Talk Geek to Me.
Hello, all.
And HPR correspondent Lost in the Bronx.
Hello, everyone.
Tonight, we're going to be discussing the dystopian sci-fi movie by George Lucas, his first feature movie, as I understand, in 1971. And
started out as a short?
Yeah, I think it was his student film or something like that.
Okay, that's what I thought, yeah.
Okay, who here has not seen the movie before?
Yeah, it was the first time for me.
It was the first time for me as well.
It was shocking. Which sounds really weird to say that it was shocking, but it was shocking in the way that the movie 1984, the novel 1984 by George Orwell is shocking, which is it just jaws you into a whole different reality. And for that, I was very grateful. You know, it was challenging to feel out the world that Lucas was creating with the movie. But then once you got into it and you could see the problems of it, it was like, wow, it's really amazing, you know. I was really impressed with the robots, the technology, the portrayal of the mind control technology they used, the surveillance technology. It's quite an experience.
And Lost in Bronx, this is your first time too. What did you think?
Well, I was first struck by the style of it. I mean, there have been many dystopian future films. I mean, they go back to the silent era. But this was one of the very first science fiction films that covered that in that truly pure feral element. You often see, you know, from Omega Man and Soylent Green and all the, you know, these things where the future is dirty and run down and falling apart and everyone's controlled in some way or another because, you know, of either high technology that no one else has access to or, you know, through alien intervention or whatever. But this film was very clean and very sterile, and it showed a nightmare world that was not disease-ridden and that was not violent or overtly violent. Of course, violence occurs, but it's always off-screen or almost always. And it's, you know, in a way, it had a real frightening feel to it because it seemed inhuman. It was so clean and so perfect. It was not, you don't have any reference to it. I mean, nothing in my life looks like that, I must tell you. You know, even after cleaning up on Sunday, my house doesn't approach anything like that world. And I don't think anyone does. And the thing that struck me the most was how the whole thing looked. And it really was immediately, you know, you're in a real science fiction. This is the future, you know, someone's future, a vision of the future.
I totally agree. yeah, that's a very good summary of it. I mean, it is so foreign looking, almost surreal in how sparse it is. But yeah, it really gets across like this almost overly sanitized future. Really kind of unique in that sense, I think. The opening sequence, I'm talking like the first 30 seconds, probably 40 seconds.
No offense or anything, I thought it was gorgeous.
Yeah, in editing was just completely unbelievable. I mean, that was just like, when I saw that, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was so unique, you know, and I'm pretty sure that Walter Murch, the editor, I know he's gone on to edit, like, a lot of stuff since then. So, I mean, it's kind of a classic edited scene, but it is one of those scenes that lives up to its reputation. It's, like, really good.
Do you know how much George Lucas had a hand in the editing of that film?
As I understand, not much. I don't believe he is an editor. I mean, I don't think he claims that as one of his skills. His wife, Martha at the time, Lucas,
mm-hmm.
I could be getting her first name wrong, sorry, but I think she might have had a hand in editing it. I'm pretty sure the other editor was Walter Murch. I'm really kind of going off of memory off of this stuff I shouldn't be, but yeah, I mean, I don't think he had much of a hand, but then again, you never know, like, was he sitting over their shoulders saying, do it this way, or was he totally hands off? You can never really know, you know?
There was I remember in the credits, there was, I don't know if this is common for other movies, but there was a person who was accredited to doing sound montages, and I guess there's this one person who did all the sound. My goodness, am I saying it right? Montages, that's how I always pronounce it. You know what I'm talking about?
Montage.
So, I don't know if that's common in other movies, but...
I don't think it is. I mean, I guess it is. I mean, it's probably just a matter of how they're talking. I mean, sometimes they'll call it, like, sound designer or something like that. But, yeah, the fact that they specifically called out, like, the sound montage was by this person, that is, I think, kind of unique, yeah.
Yeah, and the sound montage is really good.
That's another thing about that beginning sequence. It's just such it's both visually and sonically just incredible, you know?
To me, the sound is different. And in a way, it's unique the way the visuals are, but in a completely different way, because the sound is cluttered. The sound is omnipresent. Everywhere there is some sort of sound in the film, even if it's some sort of background hum or something. But then you get these very complex overlappings of radio noise or computer noise or voices or, you know, I mean, it's very, very busy while the screen is very often very stark and plain and not busy. And I think the work between the two is, I mean, it gives you at least it did me, a kind of a disturbed feeling as you watch it.
I like it really gave me a disturbed feeling as well. The one thing I do like about the opening sequence, getting back to what Cathy was saying, is that one aspect I really liked about it was, in the opening sequence, we get a brief sort of, there's like a, I don't know, like a 2-second clip of the main character. I forget his name. Well, THX-1138. Thanks.
Yeah, that would be his name.
Yeah. Where he is bloodied up. He's beaten by these robot police. And nowhere else in the movie is this expanded on. You just know that happened. And it looks like this is when he's in that prison.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, it sounds like something that was pulled from a scene that got cut, maybe, or...
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
A direction. Because he appears later on, after he's been captured, and he's placed in that very, very strange cell with all those other guys. He isn't hurt, as far as I recall. So, he didn't get that beaten that badly when he got arrested, did he?
No, he just got, like, pulled away.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, he could have spent a lot of time in there. He could have been in there for a month before we open up again to,
Yeah, it's a big, open, infinite space. You know, who knows what time and space is like there.
Yeah.
That was a brilliant, brilliant visual.
Yeah.
That was just amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
It was.
You know, in a way, you would never know this is the same guy that, you know, had anything to do with, like, the last three Star Wars films that came out, you know. I was watching this film, the one thing, and this was so distracting for me, because I'm trying to get into the movie, the one thing that kept going through my head was, what the hell happened to that guy?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was thinking that, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, THX was his first film and his last great film.
So the popular stuff, this doesn't count for you, Mr. Class 2?
No, it does. I mean, believe me, I'm as much of a Star Wars geek as the next guy, but I don't know. THX was different. You know, that's thoughtful, very good.
It certainly did not have any juvenile elements to it, as opposed to the Star Wars trilogy, which I would argue it was the Star Wars movie started off less juvenile than the later Star Wars movie.
Earlier. But what are you talking about?
I'm talking about in order of production, not in the order of the timeline of the trilogy.
Oh, you think like Return of the Jedi was less juvenile than Star Wars?
Yeah, I remember going back and seeing one of the sequels, I forget which one, and when I saw Dancing Teddy Bears, more or less, I kind of gave up.
Well, that was the later one, so you said it backwards.
It
got more juvenile as it went along.
Yeah, okay, that's what I meant, yes.
If that's true, then how do you explain Jar Jar Binks?
No,
because he came later, and if there's any juvenile element, you know, I mean, that was just unforgivable, really.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you know, I'm looking at Jar Jar Binks and, you know, and he's swinging around on an enemy robot gun or some, you know, he's doing some side gag. And I'm just struck that this can't be the same guy. You know, it just can't possibly be the same artistic vision behind these two films. There's just no way. But
yeah, I'm telling you, man.
Time passed.
It all went downhill after The Empire Strikes Back. I know that's really cliche, but
well, sometimes cliches are the truth, you know? It's just, this time it's true.
Yeah.
There was, you know, I mean, but again, after THX, there was American Graffiti, and then American Graffiti 2 was in there somewhere as well, which is actually a really good film. It's a fine film. Nothing.
That thing was horrible.
It wasn't. I really loved the, you know, the comedic elements that were involved. I liked the, I actually liked his take on Vietnam. I thought that was really well done. And I liked the, you know, the dichotomy between those elements and then the domestic stuff with Ron Howard. I thought that, you know, I thought it was well structured.
But I need to see it again.
Well, you don't have to agree either. But I mean, that's how it's okay. Is that what happened? He was a one-hit wonder, and it just sort of all faded? I mean, we can't discount Star Wars in any way. But, you know, that was an idea he had back in the THX days, you know, and it took him a long time to finally get the go-ahead and the budget to make that film. Did he shoot his wad early on?
I think we have to account for the fact that making movies is really hard, and then I don't know what kind of financing he had. I think he was financed by Coppola, so I don't know what kind of pressure there was, and the realization that he was spending someone else's money, like a lot of it, that stuff just messes you up. He probably just, I mean, you can make an art house film, but it's not going to make your money back, you know?
It could just be that. That's in his later movies, just he was much less reflected in them, just over circumstance of being so popular. And having so much weight, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For that matter, I wonder how much input Coppola had on the production, to be honest. You know, I say that because people like Steven Spielberg, who has a really heavy hand, I mean, you know, if his name is even remotely associated with a film, I mean, the film almost ends up looking like something that, you know, he produced himself, that he directed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just is very controlling. I don't know what Coppola is like in that regard, but it's so different than so much of the other stuff that Lucas produced later on. I wonder if artistically and creatively how much input Coppola made.
Yeah, that's a good question.
The thing that I really liked about the movie, the aspect that I really dug, was all these hints that this world is maintained by the people who are in it. Like THX 1138 is employed building the police. You know what I mean?
That's a good point, yeah.
That sort of thing. Or like when he's, this may be a little bit less so to that point, but maybe a little bit when they were in the prison and one of the other inmates just pushed over the police officer, just pushed him over. And I was able to crush his face. And so the respect that these people give the police officers are just, they obey them because they obey them. You know what I mean?
Well, they're drugs, too. So, I mean, that could have part of it. Plus,
yeah, that's right. They are drugs.
And we have to assume, I mean, the robot may not have been very, very dexterous, but we have to assume it's stronger than a human.
Mm.
One thing I didn't get, now, I mean, this is nitpicking, really, this part of it is nitpicking, but I do have a couple of criticisms of the film.
Yeah.
A minor one is that we're shown very, you know, in the first part of the film with THX-1138 working on these things, that this is highly, his job, whatever he has to do in the building of these things, has to do, it's very dangerous, and there's a radioactive element to this whole thing that is, if it isn't done, you know, exactly, precisely, correctly, it's very, very dangerous. So, why are these things walking around in society where, like, any mishap might crack open their nuclear casing and poison the city, you know? It's a minor thing, but it you know, maybe it was from an earlier time when radiation was seen as being more controllable than maybe we see it today. But, you know, I saw these things as like walking, you know, nuclear weapons in their way, because if they're that dangerous that you could cause a nuclear contamination while you're making them.
You don't know how directly he's making them. I mean, he might not be physically building, like, the bodies. I mean, maybe he's like, I don't know, something about the chips or something. And,
they
maybe they use a nuclear process to create the circuitry or something. Although it looked like he was putting something together, but it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, in the scene where they apply the mind block to him, he is putting a very, he's putting something that's very, very hot into one of these police officers. It's,
oh, okay.
There's no denying that. Like, there's
the
head, and he's putting it into the head. So, I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe he's not direct, things aren't directly involved in the construction of them. But I think the point was that they were, if that makes sense.
I also realize that I'm over-intellectualizing it, because if I'm paying more attention to implied science in a science fiction film, I'm probably missing the point, of, you know, the social point of it. That's why I say it's nitpicking. The thing that I didn't like, I thought that the film was unbalanced in the third half, because the third half is the third quarter, the third of the film. The last third is an extended chase sequence. It was very well done, but it seemed very different in style and in tone than the rest of the film. Far less cerebral, certainly.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the ending sequence the most for me, because I really liked the capitalistic implications of it. Because what really amazed me about the ending was that they set a budget for his... They sent a budget for his bounty to bring THX back, and they keep thinking they're going to bring him back in budget. They keep going back to that, and all of a sudden you see, you know, the motorcycle with the agents flipped, and they decrement the number of agents that are out there, and the girl just like looks at that counter and just shakes her head, and then they're calling them back. And so, you know, it's interesting, because also the fact that he is a technical worker looks like a skilled nuclear worker, but we don't really know for sure. You would presume that budget would be set quite highly, which is probably why the chase lasted so long.
The economics of it I found mysterious. In a world where the people are controlled, why do you have to pay them? Seriously. I mean, it would be much more socialistic, I would think. Less having to do with money and economics. Or if there is money handed out, it's all, you know, circular. I mean, it wouldn't really count for very much.
That's the implication of the mall scene, isn't it?
You just described the modern world, so I don't really understand how that's so improbable.
Well,
yeah, I agree.
These are people under mind control. And if they're being controlled to the point where they can't even have sex in their own home, it seems to me that they're slaves, and that you really don't need to pay these people.
Right now. I don't. I mean, that sounds exactly, practically, like like what's going on right now.
Well, what are we paying these people? He worked one day and he brought back this object and he put it into this thing and it made a flushing sound. Like, what is this? I think the fact that they're working for, like, the entire movie, when they goes into the booth and the Jesus figure 001 is like, work, be happy, and so I think the fact that they work are involved in their brainwashing. I think if they weren't busy working, they would be too busy rebelling or something like that.
Even a slave needs to be motivated in some way.
I'm sorry.
Somehow.
Wait.
Yeah, it's a point to remember.
Could you repeat what you just said, DP? You said something motivated. I didn't catch that.
I said even a slave needs to be kept motivated.
Mm.
I mean, even in our country where you have prison labor is our occurrence of slavery. You know, the people who work in the prison labor system have to be given something beyond what people who don't work get, or they just don't do it. So
it's interesting.
Yeah,
also the
shopping sequence, the mall sequence in the movie. Implies what he brings home implies that it's just an illusion of they think they're buying something of value when they aren't. It's something that's implied by the fact that this plastic shape, you can do nothing with it but throw it out. You know, but you know, you have to feel that you're being given something more for trying harder in the end, or you don't do anything. That's all there is to it. Not that I'm any expert on prison labor, Mike. I just know what I hear secondhand, you know?
No,
it's fairly well documented that the sexual slavery industry is alive and well in the United States. And the only thing those people have is hope, usually false. But they certainly don't get paid, or if they get paid, it's a pittance. And the only thing they have is the promise that one day it's going to end. And they certainly, I mean, I don't know, this might be another nitpick. I thought the structure of the film in the second or the third part was unbalanced, but looking at the society, all I'm saying is that I find it mysterious. That part isn't explained. It doesn't need to be, but it did strike me as being unexplained.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the sex industry, because a sex industry is in place in this movie. I mean, you see the pornographic sequences, and there's a masturbation machine he has, and you even see when he flips the channels that there's like a heterosexual and a homoerotic pornography available on different channels of his TV viewing, or I should say hologram viewing device. But I had the impression that he was definitely upper middle class in this society. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I had that impression as well.
I personally got the impression that there were a massive amount of manager-type people in this film, who presumably would be in some sort of higher social scale, because we have all these people watching all these other people and who are responsible for turning them in or for alerting other people who have at least some degree power over these other people.
Love, Dix's roommate watches people. I think at the beginning she was responsible for clicking in responses. And so she had some involvement in watching people, and I don't know, what do you think about that, Lost in Bronx?
I found it a little not strange. Maybe it was that level of privilege that allowed her to initially get out from under this cloud of drugs, because she was the first one to break away from the state-mandated drugs that they have to take, and she substitutes his for the placebos.
Remember, illegal evasion of drugs may result in, I don't know what they said, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but it was just that it's illegal not to take your mind control drugs. For something so critical, you'd think they'd have a more structured way of getting it into the people, like in the air or something like that.
But
I think if it was more different than it is today, taking drugs. It might not have had the same impact when you see visually that they have these pill bottles. You know, it's the same old pill bottles that you see today, and you would think in the future they'd be a little different. But I think
to interrupt here, I'm sorry, just kind of maybe nitpicking a little bit, but I think part of taking pills, I think, is to show cooperation, if that makes sense. Like, you take your medication, and if you refuse to take your medication, you're uncooperative. Or if you do, this is something, a symbol in which we can test to see if you're cooperative or not. I don't know if that was...
That's about implying that, at least for some people, the drugs don't work. Because if it was... if the drugs were 100%, they wouldn't... I don't think that they would give them to you by pill. They would find, put it in the water. They'd find some other way to make sure you get them.
Well, they do give it to children.
I don't agree with that, because, I mean, think about one of the main things that our government wants from us, which would be taxes. I mean, when it boils down to it, it's on an honor system. You know, I mean, if I didn't pay my taxes and just lied about it and stuff, I could get away with it probably for quite some time. And at some point, someone's going to realize that that's going on. But, I mean, there's a lot of things that are, I guess, they're sort of passively enforced. You know, I mean, we're all so in fear of the consequences that we do what we are told to do anyway. I think the same could be for the drug taking. I don't see why that wouldn't be left up to people.
But it could also be a hybrid situation that you're not taking into account. I mean, what I mean to say is that maybe they are doing the real drugs are mixed into the air, mixed into the water, and then they monitor the cooperativeness by having them take placebos constantly. And, you know, that's one thing. The other thing I find interesting is that at one point in the scene, THX tells his mate or his roommate, whatever you want to call her, that, you know, he can't be withdrawing on a certain day because he has so many things to do, and he can't deal with withdrawal on top of it.
Sounds familiar.
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about that. That also implies that maybe there really are no drugs to begin with, because she stops giving him the so-called real drugs, and he comes out of his state-induced trance. But maybe there never was one, and all he needed was the tacit freedom to think for himself.
Yeah, there's a point where you might ask yourself if whether or not they're all imagining that they're taking drugs, and they might not really know the difference.
Implicit in this government are they? One man is able to elude, you know, what we would assume would be highly sophisticated security systems in place, and he's able to get out.
You know, that's something you said before, Lost in Bronx, is you thought they were a management-heavy society. And the only manager I remember is that one guy who was accused of being a manager because he was doing illegal programming.
Well, I don't know that he's actually accused as a manager so much as he has access to computer systems. But there are definitely layers. I think what I was trying to say is that there are obviously many layers above the average person. There are people spying on the average guy. You know,
you could maybe sort of extend this to this idea of layers. When he's in the prison, he kind of gets help escaping from this hologram who believes he's a hologram. He doesn't believe he is, or maybe he is a hologram, but he seems to be a layer below everyone because he's a hologram now. Like, what's that? You know what I mean?
Well, he then maybe still programmed to believe he's just this TV personality that's all that's left now.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him just as a pornographic actor. I didn't see him as a person who really believes himself to be a hallucination in somebody else's screen all the time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
He was also a newscaster, wasn't he? Didn't he read the news or something like that? Or they had some debate, fake debates on the TV?
I remember that character saying, you know, that he was doing the old, what he called the old arms and legs routine. And then he made the dance motion that you saw in the porn channel sequence.
Okay. I missed that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Which I thought was totally bizarre, because the guy who was accused of illegal programming is trying to escape, is following THX, and you kind of suspect he's a homosexual man, and then you meet the male porn model on the holograph system, and he just looks at him dumbfounded and silent, and you wonder if he's going, oh my God, it's him. You know, you just wonder what his reaction really is underneath that look of shock.
I never thought about that. That's interesting.
Can I say, I thought it was a marvelous performance by Donald Pleasance, someone who'd been, you know, the heavy for so many years before and after. And he didn't play a squeaky clean guy. He was kind of not a nice man in this. But then again, it's not a nice world. But I thought his performance was understated and really, really, I mean, it was touching in a way. It was so tragic. That this man, you know, he was motivated by what we assume, as DeepGeek said, we assume it's some sort of affection or fantasy affection for THX. And he's willing to risk everything to try to achieve this. And, you know, because he must be fully aware of the consequences of getting caught. And he just naturally assumed that THX would not turn him in. Which, you know, of course proves unfounded, but then when he finds THX later and realizes that he turned him in, he doesn't care. It doesn't matter. They're together.
He says, I realize you did. It's okay. He says something like that, which is either an extreme form of forgiveness or an extreme form of love.
Everything will be all right. You are in my hands. I am here to protect you. You have nowhere to go. You have nowhere to go.
You said you've seen it many times. What, I mean, we obviously like it. What is it about the film that you think is the most important theme?
I guess there would be two. One being the, well, actually, maybe three. One being the opening sequence, just because it's really great and it does such a great job of kind of pulling us into this situation without us really knowing what exactly that situation is. It sort of reveals a lot about the world without really having to say much to us. And then the other one is that when he wakes up after he's been captured, you know, in that big cell or whatever, because at that point the storyline just takes, like, it just basically shifts, you know, because, I mean, everything changes at that point. You know, it's really, really just kind of like a big turning point in the film, I think. And then just randomly, I mean, just his little interludes in the confessional are, I just like those because they're just so, such strong, like, propaganda message from this authority figure or religiously authority figure. It's just kind of, I don't know, funny and, you know, all too true and stuff like that.
I thought it was interesting that, there are sort of religious figures. We have the booth that people confess to. We have the person who wear these clothes. They're very different. These giant hoods that walk around,
yeah.
And we never really get to see what their world is about. But there definitely is multiple characters here. It's not just a bunch of people with shaved heads. So
that's
interesting.
True. And like, in a way, it's like 1984. There is an outcast society as well. There are people that are not considered part of this society. That would be the dwarf that they portray in a somewhat animalistic manner.
that they see, what they call them, shell dwellers, I think they call them.
Yeah.
And we get the impression that they live in and around the outside shell of this underground world, or dome world at any rate.
The other thing I found
interesting, they even go so far as to show some sort of animal that attacks VHS 1138 later on. At least in the version that I saw, it had a look of CGI, which made me think it was put in later. Lucas has had a habit of doing that in his, in his movies.
Well, what I found interesting about when you talk about the different castes that are apparent is that, you know, we all know that the prison caste is usually the lowest caste. And so when he comes out of that strange communal cell, when he gets out of there, all of a sudden you see a crowd scene that you've never seen before anything else in the movie after watching this movie all this time. And that made me wonder if maybe the reason why he didn't normally travel in the circles that were exposed to these crowds, I thought maybe that was another hint as to his class and role in this society.
Well, see, that's what I was picking up on, Steve Geek, and that's why, I mean, the Donald Pleasant character, I forget his name, but that guy, I never really got that he, like, had real affection for THX 1138. I thought he was trying to get in on THX 1138's position and I guess, security, I guess, you know, like, trying to horn in on his class, you know, getting up in the world via roommating with THX 1138.
Well, that is possible that I'm reading into it, but I mean, I just assume that a guy who resorts to illegal programming, whatever that really is,
right,
to change his male from one male roommate to another male roommate, and then goes into detail, and perhaps it's stereotypical, but goes into detail about how he's heard about his cleanliness, you know.
It definitely had a.
I'm keying on a stereotype. I want to apologize for that as I say it, but, you know, I mean, I think that was intended by the movie, actually.
So stereotypical to me. It was very soft. Sexuality, even the overt stuff on the screen, you know, it's so disconnected from real life. The sexuality in general is very confused and quiet and
well, you know what they say, Lost in Bronx. Yes. They say the quietest lovemaker is the President of the United States.
they say the closet
in the Oval Office is the stealth mode closet, you know. Oh, come on, guys. That was funnier than that.
Oh, no. I thought it was funny.
I hadn't heard it.
Yeah. Talking about strange and, you know, disturbing sexual imagery, so.
Lost in Bronx is mentioning that the third part seemed kind of out of place. I'm wondering, I don't know, I kind of agree a little bit. The point that I didn't like very much, and of course this is sort of integral into the integral, this is sort of, this is very important for the plot, was the fact that they ran out of budget. The fact that they even have a budget allotted, like, what money are they spending? Like, I don't know, it didn't seem quite right to me.
There seems to be a very, you know, he seems to want to make economic statements throughout the movie, but it always makes you wonder because you never see a real product.
Exactly.
For the cost sequence, you never really see them having any material. You don't see them parading in fancy clothes.
Even with the cars, when we watched the holograms at first, this person is talking about how he went through a crowd of people and how he was just issued this card. This car, so he never actually bought it with any money.
Well, when you get to the car, another problem I have with people who work in a factory gets behind the wheel and he's suddenly Mario Andretti. You know, I mean, he's outracing machine. You know, and that didn't seem. I mean, that, I was winking and nodding at that. You know, it didn't bother me that much. And I say the third part bothered me, but it didn't. You know, everything, you know, we have to talk about relative, you know.
Yeah.
If compared to, you know, say, Attack of the Clones or something like that, it didn't bother me at all. But, you know, considering the cerebral quality of the earlier part of the film, this becomes much more physical and much more action-oriented, you know. Mm. It was extremely well done. It was extremely well staged. That was, you know, I thought most of that was miniatures and models, but I read on Wikipedia that they actually filmed that first in the uncompleted tunnels of the BART system in San Francisco. So, that you know, those were real cars they were smashing up and real motorcycles and stuntmen and stuff. So it was very well done. Very, very well done. Just the rest of the film for me.
I like the, I get the beginning of the movie, the first two parts, it very much seemed like a collage of just showing you different parts of the world. There wasn't too much plot, there wasn't too much, at least at the first part, there wasn't really anything going on. You just saw, this is the part where Thix gets a medical examination by these happy little robot things. And, you know what I mean? It's very much full of these little tiny stories that all come together. And I really like that aspect of it. Made for a very entertaining movie, I think.
It was a very thought-provoking film. Even though it didn't cover ground we haven't seen before. You know, the idea of totalitarian societies of the future and no privacy and you're constantly being monitored and one man's quest to escape from an unjust world and stuff. We've seen it all before. Yet, even though I have, it made me think very much about those issues all over again.
Yeah.
And I think that was the mark of a very masterfully made film.
Clotilde, you're kind of quiet.
That's because everyone else is saying everything. I mean, I agree so far, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I don't think I quite agree with like some of the little details that you guys are bringing up, but on further reflection, maybe I should have noticed those. So yeah, maybe I do. The money thing, I don't know. I still buy the money thing totally. I don't think that you have to have a product to generate money, since money is just a heuristic concept anyway. It's just like this arbitrary thing that we came up with. So I mean, I don't see why not. Why not pay people and make them spend their money and mind their finances and everything, even though you're issuing them cars and things like that. I mean, I don't see why a society like that couldn't exist.
Well, the thing for me that I think was kind of interesting about the money thing, and this is now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think the money ever got really to the people, the population of this place. I think maybe the money was more used for budgeting of this project or building this tunnel.
That could be, yeah.
But that kind of alludes to maybe there are other underground, like where do they get this money from? Do they borrow this money from the Federal Reserve or something? Like,
right.
I don't know. Like, how much?
Well, it's not clear, and despite any criticisms I may have had about it, it's not, I don't think it's glaring or jarring. That too brings up a point that I think is actually interesting, the idea of money being used as just another form of drug, just another way to control people. You know, if you behave properly, that you get certain rewards. It's no different than if you take your drugs to begin with and you behave properly. So, you know, that's an interesting take on it. So
yeah, I mean, that's how I've seen that.
Money has often been accused of being a drug too.
Yeah.
You know, you can make a good analogy for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. From that standpoint, I do agree with that.
You know, I mean, basically, people when we went off the metal standards in this country, you know, people were like, oh, it's taking away what's the value behind the money, and it just kept going.
Yeah.
Well, there's still people that get upset over that. I mean, the symbology of it is important. So just thinking about it and thinking about the security it brings is very, very important to, you know, well, I mean, let's be real. Every one of us, you know, worry when we can't pay our bills, you know.
Right.
So if you set up a system where you have to think about those things and then you are provided the means to control those things, it makes you feel better, you know. People who feel better cause less trouble. So it implies a massive amount of micromanaging in people's lives, but that is evidently displayed in this film. In fact, it's displayed better in this film than I think in any other film I've ever seen. You believe they're being monitored 24/7.
Right. Yeah.
It seems like it could be done. One thing that was mentioned before is the possible homosexual stereotype that was displayed, but there is one stereotype that was displayed that I actually found a little bit disturbing, and that is when they bring in the dwarf character into the prison, and then later on you see more dwarves when VHS escapes. And once again, we're seeing people with dwarfism who are being portrayed as non-human. Granted, physically, they have an advantage when it comes to playing non-human. But, that was an actor I'd seen before. He was doing films at that time, and I had seen him before. The population of dwarfs in the world is small, granted. But, we see, once again, a portrayal of a person with a physical condition who is portrayed as something other than human.
Yeah.
He was considered that way, and he was behaving like a savage in the film. Although, they wore clothes or what have you, but the implication was that they weren't like everybody else. And that I found a little bit bothersome, and maybe that's more of a reflection of the time people were. Because I'm not so sure that would be done in exactly that way today. If they were going to do that, they would have a dwarf dressed up in a rubber mask of some sort.
No, they just have like a CG or something completely different, probably.
Well,
you know?
Of course, they could do that now. Yeah, they could do that now.
I mean, maybe that is, you're right, maybe that is what he was going for, but the only resource he had was little people, But I mean, he also kind of has a thing for little people. I mean, all of them don't have somewhere.
Yeah, Jawas and what have you. Maybe he thinks they're funny, I don't know, but it bothered me when I saw it, because I think his point was that there are people who are outcasts. There are people that are not part of the society. They're not welcomed in the society.
Yeah, I got that. I got that same thing with the holograms. All the black people are holograms, and they think they're holograms, or at least maybe they think they're holograms. So they are not a part of society either, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot about that. But yeah, the actor and the actress were both black who were doing the physical channel.
That's actually, that gives it a different take, that maybe in this society, the natural evolution of white privilege comes to the point where if you're controlling everybody, you can make them the commodities you want them to be. And if your population is mostly white, you can make anyone who isn't a normally sized white person into whatever form you want.
Yeah.
These people are the monsters on the outside shell. You don't want to go there. These people are holograms, and they're there for your entertainment. That's actually a very interesting take, and it gives it a very, very different view than just simple insensitivity or what have you. It puts another layer in the film.
Yeah, it does. One that I hadn't really thought of before.
What was everyone's take on the religious aspect of the film, the way it's portrayed?
I found it a little weird. I mean, you guys know me as a technical podcaster, but I happen to be a person who has spiritual ideas too. And I found it to be very frightening, dismissive. I mean, the idea that the majority of people in a society should be satisfied by a atypical painting of Jesus and a recording, I found that demeaning.
Mm-hmm. I didn't find it that way at all. I mean, it's just that, especially now that we've analyzed it, the holograms, the whole thing about people and the outsiders being the dwarf and stuff like that. I mean, it's like he's just taking every possible method that the powers that be or, the people in charge could use to manipulate and control the population. Everything they possibly can use, they're throwing at against these people. And that goes everywhere. Money to drugs, religion, class, like poor and rich, whatever. So I just think that the point was that everything is being used as a weapon against the population. Frankly, I think there's a lot of that going on, so be aware of it.
I think it could also be seen as a depiction of how far the spiritual quality of the society has eroded, that this is good enough.
That's an interesting point.
That is when you have a government, if you can even call it a government, if you have a controlling society of this nature, it not only eliminates the need for spirituality because you're being controlled on every level, but that your quest for some kind of inner truth, you know, you don't get that option. You don't even have the ability to look inside yourself anymore.
And that
would be another way to look at it. I mean, I thought it was an interesting way that just, you know, as Platoon said, that this is just another, you know, tool used. I mean, you know, if you find your drugs aren't quite enough, you can go and talk to this painting, which, you know, will give you a canned answer. And, of course, everything you're saying is being recorded and analyzed by, you know, whoever it is that's controlling the Fox police in this particular film. And it's another good way to monitor the people, because people go in and reveal the deepest secrets. And you can, you know, take appropriate action on people maybe early on. So it's obviously a tool against them. But people don't, you don't see any indication that people are having, you know, clandestine religious meetings, which in other totalitarian societies where, you know, certain religious beliefs are in the minority, or they're depressed, or you know, there are pogroms against these people, what have you. People will plan together in midnight meetings to have their religion. You know, if people want to have a religious experience, they will do it, but not in this society. That has been taken from them.
Now, Star Wars was taken. Star Wars took place in the distant past, right?
Yeah, in another galaxy entirely.
Another galaxy entirely. Do you think this is the future, or
no,
do you think this
far,
is the
far away?
Do you think this is the future? Do you think this is something else?
Yeah, I think it's in the future.
I'm wondering if
I think it's the Val or a parallel universe like we're happening right now.
I think the reason why they're underground is because the surface has gotten so unusable that they're forced to be underground, and I think that's an indication that it's the future, because otherwise. There would be a planet to inhabit. I'm sorry?
I think you see this beautiful sunset with birds flying by indicates that life on the surface is possible. And that, to me, meant that the idea that the world outside is impossible to live in, that it's poison, that it's radioactive, that it's whatever, it's just another tool. It's another story to keep people under control. Just go out there. It's not safe. Stay here where it's safe.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that ending sequence as indicative that, you know, probably at some point in time the above ground became inhabitable, but then they had everyone living like this, and so after whatever blew over, it just kept going.
Yeah, that's kind of how I always thought too. People should make more art house sci-fi movies.
How much does it cost to make a movie anyway?
This one must have got a bundle, because I mean, I didn't know that about them filming the car sequence in San Francisco Tunnel, but I can't imagine San Francisco, the city of San Francisco, just letting people do that, you know, on the weekend, whenever they want.
According to Wikipedia, Coppola got an advance of, I think it was $300,000 to make the film. They demanded it back. They hated it. I don't know how it was received, though.
I'm pretty sure it was not well received.
It's a shame.
People would have to be totally tripped out to receive it as well. Like, this movie, I don't think the general movie watching public is still ready for that film. It's just not done.
Yeah, $300,000, they loaned them, and they insisted on getting it back. It was commercially unsuccessful. The re-release with 5 minutes edited back. You know, they made apparently the studio made a big stink about 5 minutes for whatever reason. It's a film that as I said, I had never seen it, and I always felt it was a glaring omission on my part that I hadn't. And now that I've seen it, I feel that doubly so. It's a film that anyone who likes science fiction, who likes cerebral films that make you think, this has got to be on your short list. I can see maybe why it would be a commercial success per se. It's the sort of film that, you know, spread over time, it will find its audience. But released at one time,
may not have a population at any one point who are going to love it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.